This episode is brought to you by Charcoal Book Club, the world's first photo book of the month club. Each month, Charcoal works with the most respected photographers and publishers in the industry to send handpicked books to your door. Join the club at charcoalbookclub.com and they'll send you any book of your choice from their shop free when you use the promo code MAGICHOUR. Members also get exclusive perks like signed copies, access to rare titles, members-only pricing in their online bookstore, and more. That's charcoalbookclub.com and use the code MAGICHOUR to claim your free book.
I photograph to understand what it is that I'm seeing, you know, and I photograph in order to, in a way, actively feel or be human.
I'm Jordan Weitzman, and you're listening to Magic Hour. A friend recently told me that John Edmonds' pictures of African-American men in do-rags were the first photographs that had the power to completely change his perception. It reminded me of something which Dorothea Lange said, which was, the camera is an instrument that teaches people how to see without a camera. One can speak of Edmonds' depictions of queer black masculinity in terms of their content and politics. But none of it would be transmittable if the photos themselves weren't so sensual, strikingly beautiful, and full of mystery. John earned his MFA from Yale in 2016, and since has been commissioned by The New Yorker, has had work featured in Aperture, and has shown with LTD Los Angeles. He had a solo show with him in 2017 called Higher, and another one which is up right now called Tribe, Act 1 at their Lower East Side space. The show runs through May 31st. When I went to meet John at his studio, there was just one print hanging on the white walls called Marcus with a Sacred Heart. I really love that, especially just after learning that Peter Hujar would do the same at his place. Only one picture of his on the wall at a time. It obliges one to pay a singular attention, to look hard, even for a brief moment. It seems that John has been paying close attention himself since he was a little kid.
When I was like really young, like a little kid, I've always been interested in like artistic expression. So I used to write a lot and I used to draw. And I was raised in, being raised in DC, there are so many free museums there. So like, you know, as I was growing up, I would go to museums. And being raised in like a Christian Baptist church, Christian Baptist family, I used to like most of the paintings that I first saw and were able to like identify were ones that kind of have a language of or like religious painting.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that was kind of like my introduction to thinking about like visual art, you know, and DC is a very Renaissance city when it comes to like the type of, there is a contemporary art scene there, but it's not really very visible.
Mm.
And living in a city where the Smithsonian Institution is such an important part of the city, like going to like museums like the National Gallery of Art, or the American Art Museum, or the National Portrait Gallery. Those are the first places that really sort of made me very, very interested in art and art making.
Yeah. So that was your photo background. It started, looking at a lot of religious painting. Mm-hmm. I'm curious about your family upbringing. You mentioned that you grew up in a
Christian Baptist
family.
Yeah. Huh. I mean, I have, when I was growing up, so my mom is from like the south of Virginia, from a town called Farmville, Virginia, and she moved to DC like in her early 20s. And I have three older sisters, one younger brother, but my younger brother, he's 13, and he wasn't born until I was 15. So it's a pretty like big age gap. But my mom, when I was growing up, she was married. She got divorced and was remarried when I was 15. So, it's like interesting growing up in a family where, you know, you're growing up with like all women, you mm-hmm. know, because it's really like a privilege in a way, because, you know, I was reading this thing the other day online about like how, it was about men who have sisters. I think it was saying something about like how men who have sisters have like a stronger sense of moral judgment, you know, like they have a stronger sense of morality, and they're more understanding people. And it was telling them like how the influence of like being raised, because essentially it's like I was raised by women. So it's a really intense experience too, because like, you know, having three older sisters, it's like, you know, being the youngest boy, it's like, if you're the youngest boy, you're like partly chasing after your sisters all the time, because it's like, you know, being a younger sibling, you always like want to be with your older siblings.
Of course.
But also it's kind of like, it can be torture also. So
yeah, they tortured you. They drove you crazy.
Mm-hmm.
I'm curious about how that affected your headspace as a gay man,
mm-hmm.
and how that was coming out, and if it made it easier or harder. Or
my sisters, when I was growing up, they were like, they're all boy crazy, you know? And like, I feel as though that definitely somewhat influenced me and the way that like I relate to the world and the way I relate to other men, or at least like how I was when I was, cause I feel like, you know, now that I'm a little bit older, I feel like that it has changed, you know, and I've grown more into like my own self, but that definitely had like a big influence on how I related to like other men, you know, because it was like being the youngest, and like all my three older sisters were all 3 years apart. So like I kind of saw all of them go through sort of puberty and become young women, as I kind of approached, you know, puberty and becoming a young adult as well. So, you know, a lot of the experiences that they had, it's almost like, you know how like in some movies, it's like you have older siblings too. It's like the classic kind of narrative or story is that you like look up to them and like the things that they are doing or the things that they're experiencing, like you want to experience them a little sooner because they're doing that. So I'm not trying to say that like, you know, I'm like queer because my, you know, because of my sisters, but I definitely do think that like I got more in touch with like that side of myself through growing up with older sisters and like being around women mainly growing up. So
Was coming out, was it a big deal for you?
It was, but when I, you know, first of all, when I came out to like my mother, it was like right after I finished undergrad. It felt like a big deal, you know, but now that I look at it in hindsight, like it really wasn't, and it was something that like I feel like my family already knew, you know. So it wasn't like really, I don't think it was like a really big deal in retrospect, but I think that like for a lot of people, you know, the coming out process can be like pretty, can feel pretty intense. So
yeah. So let's talk a bit about photography. I'm curious about if there are any photographers' work that you saw as a young man that you kind of really felt like, I want to do that.
Well, there are a few artists that like when I was growing up that like when I saw their work, I immediately was like drawn and taken by. One of the artists that really stick out to me, and I think that they were like someone who sticks out to a lot of people in their like younger age, was Sally Mann, as well as Nan Goldin. For me, when I remember seeing their work, I mean, they to me really represented what an artist should be, and in my opinion, there is something really amazing about an artist that can make work out of just what the world gives them on a day-to-day basis, you know? So they're just like photographing representations of their own world, you know? And it was, they're doing this as people who are insiders, you know, and not someone, you know, the typical trope of a lot of photography is, you know, especially when you look at whether it's journalism, photojournalism, is that there is someone coming from this sort of outside perspective going into a different community and saying that they are, you know, an authority, or they're representing something, or they're representing a prospective community. Whereas I don't think that, you know, that to me, the really fascinating thing about Nan Goldin's work, at least, is that it's about her relationship with the people, you know, and it's about the relationships between the people and throughout the work. And I think that I remember like someone has said in teaching, you never show your students Nan Goldin's work because everyone's going to think that they can do that, you know? And it's like, in a way, it's kind of like, oh yeah, it's kind of I can understand why someone would say that, because it is, you know, it's photographs of family and friends and it has a snapshot aesthetic, but there's a very sort of critical eye,
completely,
you know, behind that work. And I think that, you know, young people, especially when, you know, sort of the fashion industry started kind of co-opting some of the things that she would do, and this idea like the heroin chic and all that, like it became very, very easy for a lot of people to kind of copy that work or aesthetic, but even though it's so much to it. So
yeah, there's a lot to her work. I mean, her color is amazing. Her, mm-hmm. I mean, her sense of relationships in a picture. I mean, mm-hmm. she's the way she puts together a picture. They look kind of easy, but they're mm-hmm. but they're incredible.
I'm sure it's very emotionally draining too, on top of all of that too. You know, it's
her like, making those pictures.
Completely emotionally draining. So
yeah, and the interesting thing with that also is that, you know, it's you know, we could look at it now in 2018, but when she was making that work in the 70s, no one was really working in that mode. I mean,
mm-hmm.
I guess there was Larry Clark, who had done Tulsa, and
mm-hmm. Which was a big influence on her as
And I'm just curious, the Sally Mann, what was it, Immediate Family, Sally Mann?
No, actually it wasn't those pictures. It was this book that she did called At 12.
Like
all, you know, these portraits of these like young women that she made in sort of like Lexington, Virginia area. And like, to me, that work is super amazing, you know, because I think photography is really as something that is so, as a medium that seems so fixed, it's really amazing when photography is used to kind of think about these very sort of transitory periods in people's lives. Because I think that it really allows, and maybe this isn't necessarily always true for the viewer, but for the subject at least, to be able to look at that picture and see a version of themselves, you know, in an earlier stage in their lives, which I think is like very, very powerful.
So did you start working in a mode where you were dealing with your immediate surroundings on a day-to-day basis?
Yeah, well, when I first started making photographs with a point and shoot camera, I was like 15 or 16. My one of my older sisters, she let me borrow like a Kodak point and shoot camera. So that's when I first started just like making pictures of just like photographing myself and other people, and just like really making, you know, pictures of my surroundings or what I understood as, you know, understood as like my kind of like representation of my world, like how would my world look in pictures. So then it just started doing that. And I think in a lot of ways that has been a sort of thorough line throughout like most of my work is that like, I'm not going far, or I'm not looking, you know, in this completely different place. So much of my work is about place, you know, even though I'm looking at people, but so much of it is about place and people who sort of inhabit sort of place with me. So
Interesting. Are you referring to the portraits?
Well, for example, when I was also this morning, when I was doing a visit this morning, and I was talking about this photograph over here, Marcus with the Sacred Heart. This is from 2012. And when I was in DC, I photographed young men that I would meet on the streets, like on the train or on the bus. So like in a way, like all those pictures were about, in a lot of ways, about this kind of community, a group of people, you know, that were all kind of related by geography in a way.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when I had started grad school, I just started doing anything that I could think of, you know, because I mean, honestly, in grad school, I mean, I feel like this is the most difficult thing also for people who work in photography. I mean, I could have in New Haven been like, okay, I'm just going to do that here. But like, so much of those pictures, I think, have this real sense of togetherness and intimacy and closeness, because like I was the state of mind that I was in. I mean, I was actually photographing, even though I wasn't photographing in my literal home, I was photographing in my hometown.
Mm.
So when I went to grad school, I started doing just like, you know, whatever it is I can think of. I just really wanted to sort of challenge my own process of working with within portraiture and working with figuration and working with specifically, you know, the black body in photographs. So I just like started doing other kind of like trying to find new conventions and new ways within the convention of portraiture. So
is that when you started working on the hoodies?
The hoods?
Sorry, you referred to them as the hoods.
Yeah, the hoods. Okay, yeah. So yeah, that was in 2016, like right before I made most of that work while I was in grad school and living in New Haven too. But I did an installation called All Eyes on Me, and it's that was what I showed for my thesis, and it was figure with a mask, wearing a mask on his face. And throughout the installation, it's like 40 photographs. And that work is so much about the idea of the gaze and implicating the viewer in that. I mean, I think that in a lot of my work, there's like this idea of presence in a lot of it, where in the earlier pictures in the Immaculate series, it's like, you know, it could feel as though that when you're looking at a lot of them, that you're like in the space with the subjects. But I was dealing with, I was dealing with like ideas of public perception when I was like making most of that work. So I wanted to find a way to kind of radicalize that. And a lot of that had to do with sometimes not picturing the individual at all, you know, or sort of covering them in a way that you could only see, you know, sort of just like small aspects of them, and there was this sort of necessity for the viewer to kind of like fill in the blank based on whether it's, you know, a bias or how they kind of like symbolically or you know, see an item of clothing, you know. So yeah.
So that work spawned the do-rag work.
Yeah.
That was the progression.
Yeah. I mean, like, yeah. Also in between, like, I had been doing a lot of work that was about clothes but not about clothes at the same time. So it was just like I had did this piece now that I call Offering, but it was a sort of response to Robert Mapplethorpe's Man in Polyester Suit. And it was one of my good friends who actually lives right down the street dressed in a suit and unzipping his pants. And it's like a panel. What it was is I photographed him in these like two different positions and cut up the negative into 16 parts. And it's like you're looking at this body that's not whole, and it's fragmented. And so that was a work I did. I think that was 2016. But like at the time, I was doing a lot of work about, you know, this idea of clothing and how specifically at that time, like how the black male body had been pictured in the history of photography.
I want to ask you about that piece because it's a really interesting piece. And I was curious about what your relationship to Man in a Polyester Suit is. And I mean, maybe even more broadly, Mapplethorpe's Black Book or even Mapplethorpe's work in general.
Mm. I mean, I look at that work. I look at that work and I don't really... like now I look at that work, the work that I did, and I, Offering, and I see that as a really interesting kind of like radical departure, because I had not been, making it's a black and white image. And honestly, like I don't really, I make black and white. Like now, like I'll make pictures on black and white negatives, mainly because, you know, it's like you can buy a box and you can get 25 sheets, whereas a color you can get like 10 sheets, and it's like it's just more affordable.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but I feel as though photography really, you know, it's interesting, like, whether it's like controversy around certain works or people's reactions to certain works, I feel like that image just like changes over time. People always changing their mind and what they think or how they feel about something. And that's just like a nature of being human. But I look at that work, and when I first saw them, I mean, of, you know, with the Black Book pictures, like, you know, obviously, you know, I could see a lot of the arguments that, you know, Kabina Mercer, who's a scholar at Yale, who wrote about those pictures. Yeah, I could see a lot of his criticisms. I can see a lot of the sort of reactions that Glenn Ligon had when, you know, he made the notes on the Black Book. And at the same time, I also see, when I first, what really made me very interested in those pictures is that on top of the sort of, I mean, there's objectifying, there is othering in that work. However, you know, that work, when that book was actually published, it's interesting to think that when that book was actually published, that half of the men, more than half of those men in those pictures had already died of AIDS. So it's like, what I, the question I would ask myself and I'll ask anyone is that, you know, would I prefer for them to not have been made? Because, you know, he was at the same time, you know, depending, no matter your feeling towards him as an artist, he was making photographs of people who he had, you know, his own relationships with, and many of whom probably do not exist in other kind of like historical bodies of work, or, you know, many people who may have been overlooked, you know. So I think that with that work, it's to me, it's too simple to just have one reaction to it. There's a lot beyond, you know, the problems of objectification or othering. You know, when you look at Man in Polyester, I mean, I feel like that picture is obviously, you know, super problematic and fetishizing. And when I made the work kind of like responding to that, it was about how specifically in the history of photography, like you're always seen as, you know, the black male body specifically is always, you know, seen in parts or fragments. So it's like I'm representing a whole and fragmenting them to sort of partly, it's, you know, it's part performance, part critique, you know, of that work. So in a lot of ways, I think that when it comes to the Black Book, it's just a very complicated. Yeah, it's very complicated. Yeah, super
yeah.
complicated.
When you first encountered those images, was there an eroticism that you felt towards them?
No, I actually don't. No? Because like those pictures to me, they seem too cold to me. Like, I mean, like that's why, like when I photograph too, it's like I photograph mainly with ambient light, sunlight. I very rarely use like reflectors and things like that. I usually like ambient light. And I think there's just like something that's really what's beautiful about photography. Is if you go on the sort of cliche end and say, I'm trying to capture a moment, right? Mm. It's like when you use the sun or these like natural light sources, it's just like, it becomes like this laconic moment in time that cannot be recreated. So to me, that's a part of, I think, the beauty of someone like Sally Mann's work or someone like Nan Goldin's work. To me, you know, like those pictures in the Black Book, I actually don't sense a feeling of eroticism in those. They actually feel very cold and very kind of like sometimes sterile. I mean, technically they're amazing, you know, but they feel like, and that's, I think that's like, that's a part of a lot of people's reaction to it, is they just feel very, the body is almost like a prop, you know?
Yeah.
In his work. So
interesting. I guess I kind of see them like as like a similar problematic qualities to like Helmut Newton's work or Winogrand's, you know, women are beautiful, but like the pictures, they're really good pictures. How do you kind of negotiate that?
Well, it also shows, I think, in a lot of ways that, like, you know, good pictures can be good pictures, you know, but like it doesn't mean that they're like art or that they're, you know, for example, I think, you know, since I have been using her as an example, like Nan Goldin's, like the art of her work is in the desire, you know, to me, like in that sort of desire, in that sort of intense kind of yearning and want in the work, you know, to me, that's the art of her work. But I mean, that's just how I see it. So
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices
down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I want to go back and talk a bit more about the hood pictures, and I guess maybe even more the do-rag pictures. I was wondering if those pictures were at all influenced by the Beschers and the Düsseldorf School.
No. I mean, I'm not super super familiar.
Yeah.
But no, when I first started making those pictures, a big part of my kind of formal kind of training, even before visually, even before I went to school, was looking at religious painting. And there's a Spanish, I guess you would say he was part of the Renaissance. His name is Francisco de Zurbón. He's a painter he was really well known for these paintings that he did of monks, Buddhist monks, and other different types of religious figures. And when I made the hoods, I made that work simply because the first kind of moment that kind of made me want to make those pictures was I was looking at, in my own bedroom, I was looking at a hoodie that I had hanging on the wall, and it was really interesting to me and how there was a sense of a body underneath it. And I'm really interested in how even an article of clothing can conjure memory and sort of desire also. And when I first started making those pictures, I wanted to see how, my own body read in public space. And so in a lot of those pictures, a lot of the subjects in that work, a lot of them are wearing my own hoodies. So I was really interested in just picturing my own sort of figure, because in a way, it's interesting how it's really interesting in how, when you wear clothes over and over and over again, it almost becomes an imprint of your own body, mm-hmm. And there was a book that I was reading a few years ago, and I don't remember the title of the book, but one of the essays was Self-Portraiture and the Other, and it was talking about how you literally never see yourself. I mean, you see pictures of yourself, you see your reflection in the mirror, but you never see your own kind of physical body. So I was interested in how in real time and space, at times it sort of felt as though I was kind of looking at a doppelganger, So to me, if that's part of the reason why I started that work. But when I was living in New Haven, it's such a charged, Yale was such a charged space because it's such a wealthy university in the middle of this very, very economically depressed city, and the way that I think, especially for me, how perception shifts based on where you are, and based who you're surrounded by, that was a big part of my experience in going to Yale. So I was making work about public perception because I was very, very much confronted with these different sort of microaggressions and feelings of kind of false public perceptions, So that's why I started making that work. And it was really interesting because at the time, it was a really radical departure because I had just been making these very kind of intimate, lush, very kind of romantic portraits. And then I started doing that. So. Yeah, it was
right, which is a completely different mode of working. I mean, the way you present them, it's almost more of a typology. Then I guess that's why I thought of the Beschers and the Düsseldorf School.
Right. Yeah. So you're talking about the people who did the water towers.
Yeah.
Well, actually, I mean, I'm familiar with their work. I'm not extremely familiar with it, but I know what you mean. And because it's just there's something about those pictures that are so. I see what you mean because there's something about those photographs where it's so much about the architecture of clothing, you know what I'm saying?
Right.
In a way, it's super monolithic.
Yeah, and then also noticing when you see a few of the do-rag pictures side by side, each one of them by themselves is beautiful, but when you look at them together, you kind of see the differences that they evoke between.
Right. So exactly. So it's just I was dealing with I was, so like when I was making that work, it was, I had become really interested in repetition and repetition, like repetition of form, because, you know, to me, it's like, it's almost like photography. I was teaching a class when I was teaching at SVA, I was teaching this class called Photography and Language. And to me, it's like, I almost understood it as though, like the same way of like language. It's just almost like, you know, if you say this over and again, like this, it starts to, it starts to lose its meaning and becomes, either it takes on a new meaning or it means nothing at all. So I was interested in how the sort of repetition of a form kind of both sort of deconstructs and reconstructs the way we actually see or identify people who may wear these items of clothing. So yeah, I mean, I see exactly what you mean though, because it's like when I did in Toronto in a few weeks, there's going to be a public art project that I'm doing, and it's also with the Hoods Pictures, and we're doing them in they're going to be in a few billboards. And I did one billboard here in New York, and I'm doing it in Toronto, and it's going to be like a series of them. But like, yeah, I mean, I also think about outside of the sort of, I mean, there's political implications to a lot of the work, obviously, but I think a lot about poetics, you know, and just like how, you know, things can be different and the same, or how something can be same and different, you know, and just like, and the importance of nuance and actually looking, because that is, I think, what either can bring somebody closer into something or, I mean, there's like, you know, I think that it's kind of like what you said when you're talking about Nan Goldin. I mean, it's like, it's really interesting when work is like deceptively simple, you know, because, you know, I mean, nothing is easy. It's just not easy, you know, but it's really interesting when work is deceptively simple. I feel like that's a very kind of, I often feel like that's a very smart move on the artist's behalf, you know, because it kind of engages audience in different ways. So,
yeah. What else is going to be on the billboards? Is it just going to be the images or
just the images?
Just the images.
Yeah, just the images. So it's going to be 13 in Toronto, which I'm pretty excited about. I hope that it is provocative for the people who walk by it. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I want to talk to you about the work you did with the collaboration with the MoMA exhibit.
Items as Fashion Modern.
Items as Fashion Modern. It was a series of pictures that was commissioned by The New Yorker. How did you approach taking those pictures?
I was really excited to do that because it was something that I felt was already just like so in line with what I was thinking about at the time. And I was like, you know, I had an assistant and the stylist, Amanda Lee Sheriffs, she's like a vintage buyer. How it happened is that she brought all these clothes to my apartment, and with my assistant for 3 days, we just drove around and photographed. And it was a lot of fun because, you know, it was kind of like, it was almost like playing dress up with your friends, you know? And it was like, I didn't have to like do it. So even though there was a stylist, it was like the stylist was never on set. So it was like a lot of it was just up to me and like what I felt would be cool. So it was really great to like have that sense of like freedom, you know, to like do something, to do a commission for a magazine like The New Yorker, but to have such a sense of like freedom in doing it. So it was really great.
And yeah.
It was
and
awesome.
And the results are, I mean, they're beautiful. They're really, really stunning images.
Thank you. Thank you.
I want to ask you about, you've been working on a book. It's called Hire.
Yes.
Tell me about it and just talk about it a bit.
It's a book that I won an award last year through Capricious Publishing. Mm-hmm. They are publishing my first monograph, and the title comes from a show that I did at my gallery in LA, and the show was called Hire. And conceptually and thematically, the book is about, you know, this figure ascending from earth to heaven. And so it looks at about four different bodies of work and starts with the immaculate pictures that were done between 2011, 2014, 15. and which are like, you know, the more sort of traditional sort of environmental portraits. And then it goes to the do-rags and then the hoods and then tribe, which is a in-progress body of work that I'm working on right now. So it's going to be, you know, between like 70 and 75 images. So it's going to be pretty, like, you know, substantial amount of work. And I did a conversation with Micheline Thomas for it that's going to be published in it.
Wow.
And Durga Chubose, who is a writer who is based in Montreal.
Really?
Yeah, she's based in Montreal. She just actually had her first book published called Too Much and Not the Mood by FSG. Her book is very like, they're essays, but they're super poetic, you know, at the same time. And she is someone who thinks a lot about like photography in her own writing. And I've always found writers who think about photography to be so interesting because, you know, photography is, I mean, it's always had such a strong relationship to storytelling and poetry and writing, you know, in general. So
I'm reminded of something that James Baldwin said, which was, I write to find out what I don't know. How do you feel about that in relation to your own work?
I think that there is a very strong relationship to it with my work, particularly because, you know, I photograph to understand what it is that I'm seeing. You know, and I photographed in order to, in a way, actively feel or be human. You know what I'm saying? In a way, because it's like, when I'm photographing, I feel as though, you know, I equate the care that goes into making a picture, especially with a 4x5 camera, as like a kind of an act of love. You know, and I think that, you know, in making photographs with a 4x5 camera, there's a lot of, it's a process, you know, and I like that process, and I like being able to slow down and actually like really look. I mean, like, there was one time actually when I did the Items MoMA piece, and Jessica Bell Brown actually was one of the models that sat for me, and I was explaining to her, I was like, you know, you look like in the camera, I was like, oh, you kind of remind me of like my sister a little bit. And it's amazing because it's like, I was explaining like how, you know, when you photograph, like, especially when you look through the ground glass of 4x5 camera, it's like, sometimes you don't really, that is like the moment when you like put up a loop and like you focus, like that to me is the moment that you really realize how someone looks, you know, or how something looks, you know, like when you like actually like focusing the camera and you're actually like looking that intensely. So, I mean, I think that's very true in a lot of ways. I mean, I think that, again, photographers, like writers and just like artists in general, I think you should be doing it, you know, to kind of like learn in a way, you know. And I feel like, I mean, I really love when I read a writer's like text, and you can understand that they are processing their thoughts in a way. I mean, that's what it means to like have practice, right? It's to like to do something and just do and do and do and see what it actually shows you, what it actually tells you, and how, you know, writing is like framing the same way that like photography is framing, you know? So,
yeah.
Yeah.
How long have you been teaching for?
This is my first semester. I've been teaching on my own at SVA, but between undergrad and grad school, I was a TA for one of like my mentors when I was from the Corcoran. I TA'd for her. And also when you're at Yale, you have to do a TA ship while you're there as well. So this is my first semester like teaching by myself, but I really love it.
Yeah. You
know? I really love it.
What about it?
Well, firstly, that you have a group of people to like, you know, being an artist is like a very isolating experience. So it's like, you know, firstly that you have, I mean, the people that are, the students that are teaching were all freshmen. So the class being called Photography and Language in a lot of ways was about, firstly, like the idea of like legibility with photography and how we read pictures and like the things that we bring to pictures and explore. I mean, it was, I kind of covered a lot, like from also like the relationship between text and image and things like that. Like one of the artists that we thought aloud about throughout the course of the semester was Lorna Simpson, who is someone who I really admire. And we talked a lot about like a lot of ideas that kind of selfishly I was able to kind of like make the class kind of think aloud about things that I wanted to think about, you know, like, so, you know, I love teaching in this kind of like selfish way, because it's just like, it allows me to like, be like, okay, like I am setting the foundation for the things you have to think about. Because I mean, in most of the time, it's like going through so much schooling, it's just like, you're always on the opposite side. You have to like think about what they think is important. And I think that's like also a real kind of difficulty also in like being at Yale, is like, you know, or being an artist just in general, it's just like, you can have your own set of like criteria or agenda of like what's important for you in your practice, but people are always going to bring what they want to talk about, you know, to your practice. Like, I mean, like, for example, like when I was making the Immaculate pictures, like a lot of people wanted to know, you know, oh, is he your boyfriend? Or like, you know what I'm saying? Like all these are, what are your relationship with these guys? And it's just like, you know, people are, for me, I think that those pictures are just like the hoods or the do-rags. There's a certain sense of like kind of strict formality to those pictures that really allow it to be about the picture, you know what I'm saying? And about the formal qualities behind it, and not so much about, you know, this kind of like idea of like speculation about like, you know what I'm saying? That's a part of like American culture, I think, specifically, is like, we love speculation and we love scandal and we love, you know, to talk about all the things we really shouldn't be thinking or talking about. So,
yeah.
Yeah. So
thanks so much for having me over here. Yeah. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you.
Yeah. Great.
Thanks.
That was my conversation with John Edmonds that we recorded in Brooklyn. When we first started working on this interview series, it seemed like getting to 5 episodes was a big hurdle. Yet somehow the time has flown by and we've gotten to our 20th. I just wanted to thank you all for listening and hope you've been enjoying the show so far. We've got some upcoming conversations which we're really excited about, so stay tuned. We'd also love to hear your feedback, so send us a note sometimes or leave us a review on iTunes. It helps us improve the show and others to discover it. This episode was produced by me, Jordan Weitzman, and was edited by Crystal Duhaime. Music by Poddington Bear, Michelle Macklem, Damien Lazarus, and the Monks. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.